Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to the way we think and talk about China. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Happy Year of the Dragon to all the listeners. It is great to be back. Seneca is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. As we kick off this new season, I want you all to know that I won't be charging a subscription for Seneca, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I'm doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support. You can get me at SenecaPod@gmail.com. You can also support me as an individual on patreon.com/Seneca. There will be a link in the show notes and sign up for the new Seneca Substack, which I'll tell you more about later on. I also want to take this opportunity to say a huge thank you to Anla Cheng. Anla, who was the owner and the founder of the China Project, made it possible for Jeremy and for me and for all of the other people on our team to do the work that we did for 7.5 amazing and memorable years. I'm grateful to her for trusting in our editorial judgment and never at all interfering in the work that we did. I want to thank her for her just incredible generosity, not just in terms of the not inconsiderable amount of money she put into the project, but also just her generosity of spirit, her kindness, and her dedication to the mission that we were all a part of. So thank you, Anla. And I really miss these people that I got a chance to work with. You put together a first-rate team that I was extremely proud to be a part of. So in this episode, I wanted to just have a good old heart-to-heart with my dear friend Jeremy Goldkorn, co-founder with me of Seneca in 2010, and who was, of course, editor-in-chief of The China Project, which published Seneca from 2016 until the end of last year. Jeremy is actually best known as the evil mastermind behind the Taylor Swift-Travis Kelce Super Bowl conspiracy, and is really vexed that not only were his machinations ferreted out by vigilant patriots doing their own research, but were wrongly attributed to the Department of Defense and not to Jeremy Goldkorn. Anyway, glad that we could set the record straight. Congratulations. You pulled it off masterfully. Welcome back.
Thank you, Kaiser. Those stupid idiots, they didn't get the Nashville connection, you know. Taylor's from Nashville. Yeah. I'm from Nashville, you know.
And yeah, first thing you did, you had her like endorse somebody in lieu of Marsha Blackburn, right? That's your first coup, right?
One of my first moves here in the great state of Tennessee.
That was brilliant, yeah.
Anyway, enough of this nonsense, Kaiser. Before we get into the meat of the show, I would like to ask you, Kaiser, and I'm sure listeners are very interested in hearing what you're planning for Seneca for the Year of the Dragon ahead. Are you going to change anything about the show or focus on anything in particular?
Yeah, I'm sure. I've had a whole lot of conversations with people who listen to the show who have been on it. I always think there's ways to improve what I'm doing. The main thing is that even though this is going to remain a current affairs program, I am going to try not to let the news cycle dictate topics too much. And I will try to do more of those in-depth, deep dive, kind of big questions sorts of topics and guests that people really seem to like and that, frankly, I am most interested in doing. Also, never fear, Jeremy will occasionally come back on the program, dear listeners, either as a guest or as a co-host. But he's got some other things that he'll be working on, which hopefully he's going to spill the beans and tell you about. Not sure he's ready yet, but you certainly have not heard the last of Jeremy Goldcorn on Seneca. So, Jeremy, man, it's great to see your lovely face.
Thank you so much, Kaiser. I think perhaps you're the only person who would describe my face thusly. But anyway, fortunately, this is an audio program, so who's to know? And yeah, I will be delighted to be back as often as I can.
Excellent, excellent. So, Jeremy, let's start with today's show, with the whole demise of this thing that we did for the last 7.5 years, the China Project, nay, Sup China. It's all wrapped up now. We have sat Shiva and mourned its passing properly. And hopefully we are both ready to talk about the whole experience. So I want you to start, Jeremy. Regrets, things you wish we had done differently, things you're especially proud of? Maybe we should tell the story for those listening who don't know how it all started or how we got going.
Well, yeah, I mean, regrets, I've had a few, but I did it my way. I think we should start at the beginning. Perhaps we can go right back to the beginning, to Beijing in 1997, I guess it must have been, when we first met.
Yeah.
You were a famous rock star with Tang Dynasty. I was a fresh-faced editor working on a startup English print magazine called Beijing Scene. But you were also, aside from being a rock star, perhaps at that point a somewhat washed-up rock star, you were an editor for a rival startup on the brand new internet called China Now.
Yeah, yeah. That was in 99, yeah.
And we had a lot of mutual interests, I guess. Over the next decade, we became friends with a shared love of the city of Beijing, primarily, I think, is what we bonded over.
Yeah.
Good writing about it, books, late nights in low places, music, food. And then in 2010, when podcasts were just starting to become more and more popular, but they hadn't really gone mainstream yet, you suggested that there was a space for one focused on Chinese current affairs. There weren't any at the time.
Yeah.
We had a mutual friend named David Lancashire who was running a Chinese learning app, language learning app and podcast called Pop-Up Chinese. And he had a studio and he was producing podcasts. So I suggested we could ask him if he might produce a show for us, and then we would help publicize his language learning company. And the two of us were already quite well known amongst the journalist and media community in Beijing and in China, you partly for Tang Dynasty and your other music projects, but also for journalism, and me for Dunway, my website and YouTube channel about Chinese media and urban life.
That YouTube channel, the Hard Hat Show.
That's right. And I'm just looking at the date now to confirm. April the 2nd, 2010, we published the first Seneca podcast with Bill Bishop as guest about Google's pullout from China. In some ways, the perfect topic for the first show.
Yeah, it really was. Google's big announcement about its refusal to comply with China's censorship demands had come in January. I think it was like around January 9th, if I remember. But the actual pullout, the other shoe hadn't dropped yet, and it wasn't until the end of March that they took that pretty drastic action. And Bill was a perfect guest for that as well. And it's weird how we didn't do much planning for it, right? It just sort of happened, and the format just sort of stuck. It was without a lot of thought going into it.
It's remarkable how similar that first show is to even, you know, the one we're probably going to do today.
Yeah, yeah. Probably more similar than it's been in the last 7 years because, you know, it got a whole lot more formal. But, I mean, it'll stay still, I think, more like the last 7 years than the six preceding it. But, you know, we started off, I think, with a real focus on news of the week. Though I think after the first year, we started doing shows, I think, deliberately with longer shelf life, you know, interviews with authors, sometimes taking on historical topics, you know, that were completely unrelated to current affairs. But yeah, the show has evolved a little bit across the years. You know, one thing that we stuck to pretty religiously was having recommendations, and that's definitely going to still remain a part of the show. I think
a lot of people really like it. I mean, I have to be honest, it sometimes drives me completely crazy because, you know, especially when I was on Weekly, I would sometimes feel, you know, it's been a week the world isn't that good of a place that I have another good thing to recommend. But anyhow.
It definitely made me read a lot because it's like, Jesus, do I have another decent book to recommend?
So, yeah. And there was one I remember. I don't remember the name of the book, but you recommended one that was appalling. But I think most of them have been hits, and a lot of people write in to say how much they like the recommendations.
Yeah.
So we did the show. It was a hobby for both of us from 2010 until 2016. I moved to the United States in 2015, and I was still working for Dunway, which by that point had been acquired by the Financial Times, and you were mm-hmm. still working for Baidu. Mm-hmm. But you were about to move to the States, and you had to have a change of career because you'd no longer be in Beijing. And you called me up with an idea about doing the podcast. And maybe you can talk about how we initially got involved with the China Project, or Sub-China, as it was known back then.
Let me just one little correction. I actually didn't have to change careers. Baidu was actually about to move me to California. And it was actually when Fanfan and I took a trip to California to house hunt, and we were just so appalled at how much houses cost, at how terrible the traffic was. And I thought, you know, hey, we already live in a city with terrible traffic congestion and really overpriced housing, with maybe the sole consolation of excellent Chinese food. So do we really even need to move?
I see.
Yeah. So no.
So North Carolina was a choice, and leaving Baidu was a choice.
Yeah, you know, it was a scheme, actually. I really, you know, sort of, there were other jobs on the table, actually. I'm very glad. I'm sure if I'd taken one of them, I'd be very wealthy, but also probably divorced and miserable in other ways. But I, you know, almost willed this into existence. Like, we came back from that trip and, you know, went back to work, and I got an email from a guy named Amadeo Tumalillo. And Amadeo was the newly hired editor of a little startup out of New York. And he and his partner were in town in Beijing and wanting to meet people who knew something about, you know, the media business in China, who knew something about, you know, the whole landscape of what they call China watchers. And so I invited him out to the Baidu campus. We sat down and started talking. And it was pretty clear to me that they didn't really have any real assets for them except for money. And I thought, gosh, maybe they would like to buy an existing podcast that has a pretty sizable listenership already, and two guys who are both kind of eager to quit their day jobs and do this full time. And yeah, so do you remember we wrote up this little proposal, and like within a week we had a deal. It was nuts.
Yeah, although it was quite scary because the deal was had backout clauses for them at that point. We both had to, you know, jump off the cliff and leave our day jobs to do it, but it worked out.
Yeah, and I'm really, really thankful. I got 7.5 years to do this. I mean, to pull down a steady salary and, you know, to be able to still pursue some extracurricular things. And, you know, most importantly, to try to do the mission, right? To take something that had been a hobby for both of us and turn it into something serious. Now, I don't think people realize that when we signed on for this thing, we were only obliged to turn in one podcast a week. That was the whole deal for the same salary that we continued to draw for, you know, the next 7 years. You stepped up. I mean, you decided you wanted to be, you know, editor of this thing, right? You wanted to be editor-in-chief. And I wanted to expand. I wanted to do a whole podcast network. So, yeah, anyway, but I want to get back to, you know, my question about the China Project, about, you know, you said regrets, right? I mean, what do you wish you had done differently? But also, what are you especially proud of having done?
You know, I don't actually have too many regrets. I think it's easy to look back and say, you know, I could have spent more time on this or that rather than something else. But I think publishing as a business and editing, and particularly editing and writing about China, it's not, there are no obvious answers to exactly how to do it right, either as a business that's supposed to make a profit or in terms of the quality and the value of the editorial that you're creating.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really think I have real regrets. I mean, I worked hard. We had a lot of fun. We published a lot of different things. I think what I'm most proud of is, I mean, I guess our listeners are probably familiar with the concept of the Overton window, the spectrum of acceptable discourse. And it's often used sort of negatively in American political context recently, you know, that, you know, Trump says these terrible things and it widens the Overton window so other people feel free to say racist things. But I think there's a, with China, I feel as though we made people who don't generally listen to views sympathetic of China listen to views sympathetic to China. And we made people who don't usually listen to views very critical of China listen to views that were very critical of China.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, if I had to sort of say an abstract thing that I'm proud of, I think that's what we did. And, you know, I'm proud of all the podcasts, the podcast network we developed, which, you know, helped encourage a huge range of voices, you know, from Cynic itself to we worked with the China Africa Project and the China Global South Project and helped them to grow, and a bunch of other podcasts, some of which are still going and some of which were short seasons. I think we did a really amazing job of covering an enormous range of different types of subjects, from, you know, artificial intelligence and semiconductors to Xi Jinping to, you know, elite politics. We did a lot of really great stuff on youth and internet culture, feminism, on LGBTQ issues.
Well, we had Jia Yun as kind of a secret weapon in that regard. She was just so on top of that stuff that was marvelous to have.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I liked our coverage of China's relations with countries that don't usually make it much into the Anglophone press, you know, small countries like, you know, Timor-Leste, you know, countries like Sudan, Indonesia, Israel, Pakistan. We published some amazing columns this week in China's history by James Carter.
You know, I'm talking to Jay later today about seeing whether we can still, you know, keep his column going in some way.
That would be fantastic. So, I mean, that was such a wonderful column. And in fact, it wasn't me who found that. It was Bob Guterme, our CEO, who was the one who approached Jay about it. And it turned out to be one of the best things we did editorially.
Absolutely.
I've really had a lot of fun with Paul French's Ultimate China Bookshelf.
Oh, yeah, he's great. Everything Paul did for us was fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was Queer China, mostly written by Nathan Way, which, you know, was a regular coverage of issues serious and frivolous in China's LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
We published a lot of stuff about what's going on in Xinjiang, Uyghur Bulletin and Window on Xinjiang by Darren Byler, which I think covered the Uyghur crisis and atrocities in Xinjiang with a level of granularity that no other English language media has done.
Wasn't just granularity, but also, you know, I mean, Darren is really authoritative, but also fact based, and he's grounded, and he's just extremely, I know you hate the word nuanced, but he did it with nuance.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I don't really hate it. I hate the way it's used a lot of the time.
Right.
I don't hate the player. I hate the game. No, I don't hate the game. I hate the player. Another really fun column was Phrase of the Week by Andrew Methven, which took a word that was being used a lot on the Chinese internet and in Chinese media and explained us with a great deal of background information. So I'm probably leaving somebody out that I should mention, but those are some of the things that right now come to mind. You know, we published more than 400 contributors' work,
right?
And almost every one of them, I'm extremely proud of.
Yeah, there are some people I think who even, you know, I mean, after we announced our demise, a lot of them came out and said, you know, hey, this is where I got my start. These people gave me a chance. They were the first people to pay me for my writing. I've now gone on to blah, blah, blah. I mean, in our long history, if you look at people who have interned for us, who've gone on to pretty, you know, stellar journalism careers, I'm very, very happy with what we've done. Even before we joined, you know, with Anla Cheng and SubChina, then the China Project.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something about the work that you did there, which I'm not really sure people fully appreciate, because you worked your ass off. I had I got to say, I had the lead. You once said you get to be the tenured professor of our outfit. Yeah, it kind of was the case. Yeah, I had the leisure to read a lot. I mean, I had to, right, for the show, right? I wanted to this thing where I read the book if I'm going to interview an author, right? But I got to direct a lot of effort into that one show each week. Plus, of course, all the engineering and the editing and the production work on the other shows in the network, sure. But let's just say this. I mean, you had to deal with a lot more day-to-day aggravation than I did. It's absolutely true. I'm super grateful to you for that. But, you know, one thing we always talked about, you weren't able to ever get off what we internally were calling the editorial hamster wheel. You weren't actually just the editor-in-chief. You acted, you functioned as a managing editor, I feel like. You think that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, media startups are punishing. It's one of the most difficult businesses in the world. And it's incredibly difficult to figure out the right balance between the quantity of output and the quality of output and, you know, what your reward is for that, both financial and in terms right. of emotion. So, I mean, I think that was, you know, the company before you and I joined, the initial product was a daily email newsletter. And that kind of defined the pace for the whole of the company's life. And a daily deadline is it's a bitch.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bitch. It's the work of Sisyphus, you know.
Yeah.
Every day you got to roll the boulder back up the hill. Or, you know, Bob used to talk about it. Our CEO, Bob Gutama, used to say that it's like running a bakery, the media business.
Right.
Every day you got to make fresh bread. And if the bread sucks and somebody eats the bad bread that day, they'll think you're a bad bakery, which is right. different from other kinds of businesses where you don't have to make the product fresh every day.
Yeah, man. You know, I think from the very beginning when we started doing this show, there were clear sort of stylistic, not just stylistic, sort of political differences in the way that you and I approached talking about China. Maybe it's a little bit of a sensitive question, but how would you characterize that difference? I mean, it's not as simple as, oh, he's a panda hugger, oh, he's a dragon slayer. I mean, I often get criticized by people who saw me as one of them, you know, like that they thought I should be in their camp. I'm like, you know, quote unquote pro-China. But you know, because I had this professional association with you, because I was always defending, you know, things that you would say that were at odds with my own thoughts or beliefs, you know, people would get pretty angry with me. And I'm absolutely sure the same thing happened to you. So how did you answer them and how would you characterize that difference?
Well, I think in some ways it is as simple as a panda hug and a dragon slayer. Perhaps to be more accurate, it's that your first reaction to some piece of news about China is to look at it from the point of view of China, which can mean the government, the Communist Party, can mean just ordinary Chinese people. But your first instinct will be to look at it from a sympathetic point of view.
Empathetic.
Empathetic, let's call it. Empathetic. Yeah, that's right. Whereas my first instinct, probably dating back to about 2009 or so, has been to look at it from a critical point of view and to find, you know, because it is a problem in, I think, in the China watching community, the business community about China, is that it is a Sino-foreign relations. There's a lot of people who like to sugarcoat the truth or slightly tweak what they're saying in order to make it more comfortable for, you know, the Communist Party or our Chinese guests or the Chinese partner.
Right. Whereas I would see the problem as being there are more people, you know, who refuse to sort of reach for any additional context, to just sort of look at everything completely out of context and are really, really quick to sort of pass sort of moral pronouncement on things without.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And I mean, I think the odd thing probably is that both of us, you know, if faced, you know, if I'm in a room full of ignorant people saying terrible things about China, I'm going to sound a lot more like you than I usually do.
Right.
And I would imagine you're the same.
Yeah, absolutely the same. I end up sounding a lot more like you, channel my inner Jeremy Goldcorn, when I hear, a bunch of just sort of slavish, idiotic, complete, well,
tanky talk.
Sugarcoating. Yeah, tanky talk. Right. But I think the balance worked, and I think it it worked because, you know, even though we would fight, we would have, you know, arguments in editorial meetings all the time, but they were never personal and they were never, I mean,
most
they were
of the
always,
time.
You know,
I think we both got quite angry at a few points, but not often.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, though, Kaiser, is that, I think to understand China, China's history, where it's going, where it is right now, it feels to me like you need something like the scientific method. You know, you need to be able to constantly reassess your ideas and sometimes change your mind about things because it's a complex beast, you know. It's... the elephant parable, right? The five blind men touching the elephant, and the one touches the tusk, thinks it's like a spear, and the one touches the leg, thinks it's a tree, and the one touches the trunk, thinks it's a snake. And it's very easy when looking at China to get stuck on just the little bit that you're touching. And it's very important to have your assumptions challenged frequently.
It's funny, I just used that just the other day. I gave a talk in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where the blind men and the elephant was the thing. And I was in the context of these days, it's all tusk. You know, that is, it's that weapon of war thing. Everyone just looks through that one lens of national security. And right.
Which tusk I think and is a, snake.
Yeah, exactly. Tusk or snake. Right. If you're in the intelligence community, maybe it's snake. And
Yeah.
Anyway, but, I mean, I think it's fair to say that both of us brought, you know, our own kind of prejudices into it, our own emotional baggage that's, you know, created by our own personal experiences there in China, good and bad. And I gotta say, I mean, I had a lot of really good ones. I'm sure you did too, but you also had some very bad experiences. My bad experiences were relatively few. They've just been, you know, I think they're fun stories to tell, but on balance, you know, I was on this hilltop surveying the surrounding countryside and seeing a lot of, you know, happiness and a lot of progress and a lot of excitement. I mean, working in the tech industry there, and then, you know, getting to play with a bunch of really amazing musicians. Yeah, I had a pretty happy time. And, you know, you, not always, right?
No, I mean, you know, most of the time I was very happy and I can't pretend to have, you know, really suffered. But I mean, going right back to my very first experience, I mean, most of my experience was doing small entrepreneurial things, mostly in the media space. So I was constantly running into, you know, low level and sometimes high level trouble with the authorities in a way that you simply weren't at Baidu, where, you know, you have like some of the smartest, you know, most liberal minded people in China in this beautiful office. And, you know, it's one of, at the time, certainly, you know, one of China's national champions and one of the parts of China that when you look at it, you think, wow, that's good, you know. Whereas I think I often would run into problems of the parts of China where you think, that's bad.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. I don't know if all of our listeners know your whole storied past. I mean, you just made reference to having been in a bunch of media startups, and that goes back all the way to, what, 90s, 97 or so. Give us a highlight reel, Jeremy. Tell us about, you know, your involvement. So you mentioned Beijing Scene at the very beginning.
My first media job, startup, print weekly newspaper modeled on American Alt Weekly, started by a guy named Scott Savitt, who was a very gifted publisher in certain ways, but also, you know, got into a lot more trouble than I ever did for a whole bunch of reasons. Mm-hmm.
Not all of them related to, you know, his passion for you know, journalistic integrity, right?
Yeah. Scott kind of taught me how to operate like a startup business in Beijing, which was basically don't listen to any rules, just do whatever the hell you want and say sorry when they come after you. So, you know, in some ways, a curse on him for the rest of my career. But so I quit that just before its final collapse in 2000. And then I joined, you know, it was .com boom time. So I joined Phoenix Eye, which was a joint venture between Phoenix TV and some VC people in California. And I lived in Mountain View for a few months.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Chris Barden and I were the only Lawai on the team. So it was quite weird. I moved to America for a little while, but everybody I worked with, except for one guy, and everybody I socialized with was Chinese. So it was this kind of weird Chinese bubble in Silicon Valley. And I quit that just before its demise because it was, you know, the market crashed. That it was the dot-com crash and I could see which way things were going. And I went back to Beijing and I started a magazine called R, which was a listings magazine, sort of, you know, like based on the listing section of Beijing Scene, which by then time was long gone. And it was bilingual, print as well. And we did, I don't know, I think about 7 or 8 issues, and I sold it to a media company named CIMG, started by a lady named Hong Huang, who is sort of relatively well known in China, at least amongst a certain generation, entrepreneur, and she was one of the early group of people to come to high school and university in the United States. Her mother was, you know, Mao's English teacher and translator. So it was a kind of, you know, she knew her way around Beijing and she was starting this publishing company. So she acquired our magazine and for various reasons, we changed its name into Le, as in, you know, happiness, Zhao Le.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so we ran that for a while and that eventually was sold and became Time Out magazine, which I think is still going in Beijing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that that was the origin of Time Out there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Just became sort of the Beijing franchisee of the whole Time Out empire, huh?
Yeah, but then it was no longer with CIMG, you know, media business. Yeah. It's
Hu Huang is such a character, my God. I mean, one day we can do a whole show on her.
Yeah, I have some good interviews with her on YouTube, actually, from a little after those days. But and at that time, also, we launched a magazine. This was her brainchild called Red Egg, which was, you know, slightly a copy of Red Herring. It was a technology magazine.
Where I happened to be working at the time, yeah.
Where you were working at the time. So it was Chinese language, and Huang decided to make me the editor-in-chief. Now, I mean, my Chinese is self-taught. I'm very good at reading state media, and I can write in Chinese okay. But it was quite an eccentric idea. But, it, you know, it kind of worked. But CIMG was also full of dot-com bloat. And as the cash began to wind down, you know, some of the publications closed down. And that included Red Egg, unfortunately. And then I helped Mark Kitto, who was the founder of That's Beijing and That's Shanghai originally. Which I helped him launch That's Beijing. That was just like a short job. And that's now the Beijing are still going, I believe.
But, you know, one of the things that you did as the launch editor was you enlisted me as the back page columnist.
Right. And you wrote this for many years, this wonderful column about Beijing. It was really like a love song to Beijing, the column, really.
It's called Ich bin ein Beijing.
Yeah. So some of the most lovely descriptions of the city. And in fact, you published a book of the columns, didn't you?
I did in 2009.
That's right.
Not all of them. I mean, if anyone's interested, I have them all. I mean, I can send somebody a PDF of the whole damn thing. I mean, all the columns.
Send it to me, actually, please.
I will.
Yeah. So, and then I kind of, the media business, I should have listened to myself all the time ago. The media business was clearly rather exhausting. So I went into business with a couple of friends.
But you're a glutton for punishment, apparently, yeah.
Doing advertising and graphic design. We started this little design firm.
Mauro Marasciali.
Mauro Marasciali and Jonathan Leonhufud and Jacopo Della Ragione for Lawai. We started this design and advertising firm. And I did that for a while, but I had thought that it would offer the same kind of creative satisfaction as media, but it would be more profitable and without the government trying to shut you down all the time. But I hated it. I couldn't work for clients. You know, I think the low point was
client
at
service
one point,
is the worst. Yeah.
We did this design for this luxury hotel for some graphic design stuff. And we'd passed through many rounds of approvals. And the basic logo was like based on squares and rectangles because it was Beijing. And it was, you know, the city map of Beijing is all squares and rectangles.
Sure.
And the big boss came from Hong Kong, Cantonese-speaking Hong Kong guy. And he said to us, no, we can't have this. This is Chinese people like round things. So you've got to change it all. And I think that was the day I thought, you know, I can't do this anymore. And I started a website called Dunway, dunway.org. It was based on, you know, blogging had become very big. And it had become very interesting because 2003 was the year the Iraq war started. So you had left-wing and right-wing people, pro and anti-war people in the United States blogging. And it suddenly, I realized any idiot can start a website. You know, it's that easy. There was a slight technical hurdle, you know, a bit more difficult than getting on Facebook, basically. But so I started this website, and it was initially translations from the Chinese media and commentary on the Chinese media. And then it grew to encompass, you know, publishing a fairly wide range of different kinds of writing. But usually the slogan was media, Chinese media, internet, and urban life.
Right. I think advertising was in there at one point.
Advertising, right, yeah, right. Advertising at one point. So we covered the advertising business, the media business. Then we started making videos with Luke Mines and Anna-Sophie Livenberg called Downway TV.
Sexy Beijing, right?
Yeah, so we had the hard hat show where I'd wander around the city with a hard hat, which was a kind of symbol of Beijing at the time because everywhere was a construction site full of, and I was a migrant worker like the people wearing the yellow hard hats. And Sexy Beijing, which was sort of a bit of a parody in, of Sex and the City, which was very popular in Beijing at the time amongst right. young women. But it was an interview show where Anna-Sophie would go around asking people slightly embarrassing questions about romance and English names and things like that. So that was a lot of fun. And in 2000, and, you know, it was a struggle. I mean, I was very poor for many years. Often, you know, I'd go out to dinner with like 50 yuan in my pocket and just hope that no, you know, either somebody else would pay for the dinner or, you know, that I wouldn't get stuck, you know, having to admit that I had like, literally my net worth was like 50 yuan, you know, like $10.
That's terrible.
So, I mean, we started doing research work to pay the bills, research on internet and social media for companies and financial institutions. And that eventually grew into a real business, which is basically what the Financial Times was more interested in buying
right.
the as a business anyway. But so we carried on doing that for a while. And then, you know, after selling it, I had kids and my wife and I wanted to move to the States back for her because she'd come to college here and become an American citizen. And for me, it was the first time to really properly, well, I emigrated, you know, with a green card.
Right.
And that was just before, that basically takes us up till, you know, the beginning.
When we got acquired,
the China Project.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, listening to you recount that, I'm just struck by how Beijing in those years was just this wonderful place where you could kind of instantaneously reinvent yourself, where it just seemed like there were no restrictions on what we could do. You know, if you had a crazy idea, you could just sort of go for it and nobody was going to stop you. Nobody was going to tell you, you know, that's a bad idea. You're an amateur. I wrote a column in That's Beijing about precisely this phenomenon, how liberating it actually was to be in this place where there wasn't anyone to kind of do a reality check, tell you don't quit your day job. You know, a lot of us, we all had like half written novels and screenplays on our hard drives. You know, everyone sitting in the bookworm with, very different time. But when we started Seneca back in 2010, I think that we had an inkling. I mean, I think that it was already fairly clear to us that there was a major shift happening, that there was a change taking place. And that became kind of a leitmotif that threaded through many years of the show. It was noticeable just in the years immediately following the Olympics. It's an obsession with me, actually. I mean, it's something I love to talk to people about, especially people who were there at the time, just reflecting on that whole crazy chain of causality. What happened? What are the main factors in your mind that you would point to for why you think things changed when they did? Remember, I used to call it the new truculence, but you know, it became something much worse than that. I think we joked it was like it's the new fuculence.
yeah. I mean, we've talked about this many times, and I circle back on the ideas. And recently, I've been thinking that it really started with the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, at least when it comes to Sino-U.S. relations, just because I think, for the first time in China, there began to be the sense that the US is really doing a dumb thing. But I don't know about that. I mean, there was also a sense in China that we better, you know, develop the military because look at the awesome firepower these people have.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the Kuwait War. I mean, there was, you know, before that,
even before that, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, the change, I would say, you know, 2008, you had the Olympics, and China came out of it looking very, very good globally. I think it really was truly a soft power coup. And perhaps more importantly, within China itself, whatever any foreigners thought, Chinese people thought that China had arrived. You know, the journalistic cliche of the time was China's coming out party to the sure. world. But it actually, you know, it was a good cliche because it was in many ways. It was the first time the world, many parts of the world, woke up to the fact that China was no longer a poor, backward country. And I think Chinese people also felt an enormous sense of pride. And then that was immediately followed by the global financial crisis, when suddenly America looked pretty dumb in a way to I think, many Chinese people. You know, the people who were supposed to understand the whole world of business completely screwed it up. And that year, there was also the so-called, you know, YouTube or Facebook revolution in Iran, where you had an election and then popular protests that were fueled by social media.
Yeah, after Ahmadinejad was reelected, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that started to provoke a sense of paranoia in the Communist Party, both about how easily seem to organize popular movements because of the internet, but also the fact that they, you know, also being an authoritarian regime, to use a word you don't particularly like, were vulnerable to the same forces that the Iranian government was. And the same year, just a few months, basically immediately following the Iran protests, you had the riots in Urumqi, race riots, essentially, where Uyghurs and Han Chinese people were
killing each other,
you know, killing each other on the streets with clubs. That was followed by about 6 months of the entire internet being shut down in Xinjiang, you know, and that felt like the start of something. And I have to say, like in my own personal experience, 2 days before the Urumqi riots on July the 3rd, Dunhui was blocked in China.
Yeah.
And so, well, I mean, whatever that means.
The whole run-up of, like, again, it's like the anniversary date. It's like, you know, if you look at when Facebook actually was blocked, it was actually blocked in the run-up to the anniversary date of you know, June of 89, right? So at the end of May of 89, that's when I think Facebook actually finally got blocked.
End of May 2009.
Right, right. And in the previous year, you know, it had been spotty.
Yeah.
Especially after March, after the Tibet riots in 2008. It's interesting, though, Jeremy. I notice how much you emphasize the internet in this this explanation. It's not something I hear from a lot of other people. And it's something that I completely agree with. I mean, I think one of the things that people under index on is the extent to which the party was absolutely terrified of the force of the internet. I mean, people don't, you know, I haven't seen a lot of books written about that, but, you know, as I've often said, it was like impossible in that time to open up to the editorial pages of any broadsheet in America or in the UK and not see the argument being made that freeing the internet would bring down authoritarian regimes, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were. Yeah,
and then,
were,
you know, I mean, we've kind of taken it up till 2009, but from end of 2010 was the
Arab Spring,
the Arab Spring. So, you know, December was the guy with the street stall in Tunisia self-immolated. And then January, February was the Arab Spring. And there was the people calling for Jasmine Revolution in China for Jasmine strolls.
Yeah, all four or five internet. Of them, yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, people did gather and things happened. Like,
it was like mostly journalists.
Well, no, there were people that were, you know, people threw down a jasmine flower. I mean, there weren't a lot of them, but there was chat on the internet. Right, and right, what right. happened, that you will agree with me, is that then Ambassador John Huntsman happened to be coincidence in Wangfujing the very day that one of the, you know, there was supposed to be this jasmine gathering.
A very handsome bomber jacket. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I, you know, the Chinese authorities took note of that, and they didn't like what they thought they were seeing. So I, the internet is hugely important. But I think the last thing I'd like to mention about the hardening of attitudes in China to foreign and liberal ideas is, I think one of the most telling pieces of writing over the last 20 years was the 10 grave problems inherited from the Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao administration, an essay written by Deng Yuwen, who had been a big shot at the Communist Party School, a scholar. He was the editor of Study Times, their publication. And he analyzed 10 problems that had been left behind that, you know, the next administration, i.e. Xi Jinping,
would have to tackle. Yeah.
And they were, you know, very real problems. They were, you know, environmental pollution, corruption, inequality in society, you know, in all kinds of unequal distribution of resources, and the instability that, you know, came with these things. And you had Xi Jinping appointed or anointed as the guy who actually had to take care of these things. And they were right. I mean, remember Beijing in the first decade of the century, if you had a black Audi with, you know, Wujing, like People's Armed Police plates, you could do anything, you know.
Yeah.
You could ride over pedestrians and kill them and nobody would stop you. You could go through red lights. You could park wherever you wanted, you know. You'd go to, you know, the Landmark Hotel, and there was a nightclub there that, you know, was notorious for being like a brothel that everybody in the city knew about. And, you know, you had very, very poor people who had to, like, look at these black-tinted Audis drive past. I mean, there was a sense that there were inequalities that could lead to a crisis. And I think very much Xi Jinping came along and was like, I'm going to sort this stuff out.
Yeah.
But part of it is that his way of sorting it out is to, like, lock everyone up and sense everybody and beat everybody up. To be glib about it.
Yeah, no, in those days, I remember Ian Johnson joking, Audi, the official car of official corruption.
Yeah, that's right. It was, wasn't it?
Yeah. But no, I mean, I think what you just talked about, the 10 grave problems, that really dovetails well with what Susan Shirk wrote in her book, Overreach, which is a really, really excellent exploration of another whole facet of the reasons for China's kind of hardening in you know, internal repression and external assertiveness, right? She actually talks about just what we were talking about. We thought of it as a feature, not a bug, that China's leadership during that time was collective. We always talk about, you know, we don't talk about the Hu Jintao era, we talk about the Hu and Wen era, right? I mean, it gives you an idea of how different it was and very collective. But as you say, you know, it gave rise to just really, really rapid corruption, a lot of serious social inequalities and things like that. But it was the corruption and the ability of so many of the powerful Politburo members to kind of ensconce themselves into these, you know, power bases. They had these whole industries behind them, right?
The good thing about it, of course, I mean, the corruption was bad, but the good thing about it was that it was almost a kind of a separation of powers, in the sense that, I mean, I remember, like, in the publishing industry,
at one point,
Beijing Scene, we had a license from one arm of the People's Daily that allowed us to publish. And, you know, we had a rival magazine that had a license from some other government entity that allowed them to publish. And we were both, you know, allowed to kind of struggle against each other because there were two different backers who were both pretty powerful. That doesn't exist now.
Yeah. I mean, back then in those times, if you were like in internet video, I was working for Yoku at one point, if you recall, there was a jurisdictional fight. Does internet video get regulated by
SOFT, the state administration of radio, film, and television?
Or is it the
internet authority?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The MIIT, right? The Ministry of Industry and Information Technology. That's right. And then there were other people, you know, grasping for power, like the Wenhuabu, the Ministry of Culture, always kind of impotently try to, you know, get their hands on some of the goodies.
Right.
Yeah.
So no, your point is it's a good one that in that time there was an effective division of power, separation of powers
makes it, I think, gives one the
wrong
impression.
Too nice of a gloss. I
mean, it was like deliberate. Warring states, so you could play one warlord or against the other.
More like that. Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, and I And it just reminds me of living in China. I noticed this thing happening with myself in my own politics, right? I was a 20-something Berkeley graduate, right, when I went to China in 88 to stay there for my first year, just fresh out of school, and the feeling, you know, myself very, very left-wing politically, right? I was really into, you know, things that were egalitarian and distributive and anti-capitalist and, you know, the usual. In my case, though, I think being in China for all that time, I found myself so habitually siding with or rooting for the kind of market reformers, for anyone who I thought was on the side of the private sector, as opposed to the SOEs, you know, those big, bloated, state-run enterprises, state-owned enterprises. And I think I maybe imbibed a little too much of the neoliberal Kool-Aid, especially in the 2000s, and only came to realize once I was like gasping and choking on pollution and seeing the horrific inequality around me and corruption and the materialism. Eventually, it just got too much for me, and I started being much more sympathetic to the new left and to some of the other forces that were kind of mustering against those social ills that we were seeing. Did anything similar like to that happen to you in your own politics?
That's interesting. I mean, I think I have perhaps just always. How to put it? I went through a left-wing phase as a college student. And in fact, when I arrived in China, I remember one of the slogans I'd learned the English of that I most liked was Ya Fei La Tuan Jie Qi Lai Da Dao Mei Di, you know, like Asia, Africa, and Latin America unite and overthrow the American imperialists, you know. So, I mean, we're talking like undergraduate nonsense, really, appealed to me. But I never liked being told what to do. And I always found, like in China particularly, just the state, when it decided something, was so heavy-handed that I think I remained generally on the side of private enterprise. I don't think I drifted back leftward much. Although, I mean, I do believe in government regulation. You know, I'm not a libertarian. I think, you know, pollution is a problem. You know, climate change, just old-fashioned pollution is a problem that you can't solve without a heavy-handed government approach. So I don't know. You know, just listening to me now, you can hear that I'm a little bit all over the place. I don't think I changed in the way that you described, though.
Okay, interesting. I've shared that experience with some others in, you know, who were in our cohort there. And I have heard people, you know, say, yeah, that kind of happened to me too. And I didn't recognize myself. You know.
Maybe a better answer actually is that the opposite happened to me, actually. In fact, I think, yeah, a better answer is probably the opposite happened to me, because the tough times that we've sort of alluded to that I've had in China have mostly been because of government interference with what I was trying to do. So I have found, you know, like living in the United States, it's one thing I really like, that it's like, you know, here I am, get off my land, you know.
And at the same time, I remember you, you know, in those go-go years of the mid-2000s, just really sort of singing the praises for how unfettered and how easy it was for you to start a company and things like in China. You were...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, I guess what I learned was it's very easy to start a company, but to keep a company, now that's a different proposition.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit. I mean, you were saying earlier about how, you know, important it is to not just touch the trunk or the tusk or whatever of the elephant and see it all. But I mean, that's one of those things. I said I gave this talk about, you know, what I look for in a China watcher. That is to say, I give this talk, and I've given it a few places, about what, you know, because we live in this world where not everybody is going to be able to dedicate all that time to you know, becoming quote unquote expert. That's a ridiculous word, of course, but you know, to really be becoming familiar with all the ins and outs of Chinese politics and American policy. So they have to rely on other people. And so, you know, I propose a set of criteria, five things that I think you should look for in a China analyst. Does this person know what they're talking about? Is this person worth listening to? And, you know, I should emphasize that possessing those five qualities doesn't mean they're going to arrive at the exact same prescriptions that I would. But, you know, it's I think, important for us to kind of know what to look for. What would your list look like, Jeremy?
I don't have a list like you, I don't think. But I suppose the most important thing is, if you're coming at it as an outsider to Chinese culture, you require an awful lot of immersion in the language and culture and history to even be able to say anything coherent. And if you're coming at it from as a Chinese person, you have to really figure out how to explain a lot of things that are not very easy to explain to an audience who has no idea where you're coming from. So the dedication to, you know, immersing oneself, if you're coming from the outside, in the language and the culture and the history of China, I think is, you know, it's a question of time that you have to put in. And if you haven't put in the time, you're just not going to get it. And, you know, if you're coming from China, you have to figure out what are the kinds of questions that people outside of China are want to know about. And you also have to come at it, you know, if you've come from the PRC system, you have to realize that the average American's worldview is fundamentally different.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can call those things whatever you want, but there is an amazing reluctance on the part of a lot of Chinese people who attempt to speak to the outside world to actually figure out what it is the outside world wants to know and how they come at the gaining of that knowledge.
Yeah. And for that reason, they've been very, very ineffective.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting. I hadn't, that's actually a whole nother topic that I should probably address in an essay or something. I think it's a big, 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 interesting topic. So, Jeremy, I recently listened to a guy I really admire, Andrew Batson. We know, you know him, right? He used to write for Wall Street Journal. Great, great guy.
And he's been on Seneca, I believe, back in the day. Chinese days.
Yeah. A couple times, probably. Anyway, he was on Jude Blanchett's excellent Pekingology podcast. And he had, I mean, we're talking about kind of, you know, basic observations, things that, you know, help you kind of get the way Chinese people think. That's a really super important thing to be able to talk about. And he did a fantastic job. He said Chinese people have this fundamental belief that they not only can be the best in any given field, at any given endeavor, but that they should be the best. I thought that was so true. I mean, it never really occurred to me to put it so succinctly, but it struck me as it resonated with me right away. I have a couple of those kind of chestnuts that I'll haul out when people ask me, you know, what should I really know about the Chinese worldview, or what are some of the things, the big picture kind of takeaways for you about Chinese people?
I mean, it's quite difficult to top that one.
That's a good one.
I mean, I don't really know if I can think
but
of anything.
But you agree
right
with that
now.
One? That you?
I do agree with that one.
Yeah.
I would add a sort of corollary to it, which is your maxim about the difference between Chinese and Americans. They're both exceptionalist cultures, but American exceptionalism, let me see if I have it right, is the idea that all people on the world should be able to enjoy what Americans enjoy and that this is the right way to live.
Right.
Whereas Chinese exceptionalism is only the Chinese can do what the Chinese do and no other peoples can do it. Is that about right?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah, put it a little differently. I'd say, American exceptionalism is proselytizing. It basically says, yeah, American institutions and values are, you know, true for all people in all times, the best. And the Chinese are exceptionalist in a very particularist way. You know, I mean, it's right there in the way they always talk about so-and-so with Chinese characteristics, right? There aren't universalist claims being made. The idea is that China's own experiences are unique to China. And so I think there's really something to it when China insists that it's not trying to export a model, right? A China model, even a development model. I mean, it's just like, look at the language thing, right? We would never have a television show in America with people from other countries who, oh my God, can speak fluent English, right?
Yeah.
It just would never happen, right? So yeah, there's this idea of China itself as inherently inaccessible to the outside, and anyone who does seem to have it, you know, is suddenly accorded this label, "中国通," right? You know, wow, he's a 中国通 because he can say "你好" really.
He can say "你好." Yeah, it starts after you learn to say "你好," basically.
Right.
I mean, it's difficult to top those two. I mean, food, I think, is like, if you don't understand Chinese food, you can't, like, the obsession with food and how important it is and how good it is. If you don't understand those, then you have no way of understanding China, and you're also a very sad person.
that I can absolutely agree with.
I don't know. What do you tell me? Have you got some other maxims that you know, China 101 in 2 minutes, how to understand the Chinese mind?
There's the one I always use. I mean, this isn't about the eternal Chinese mind or anything like that, but it's definitely about understanding today, you know, modern China today. I mean, I've probably said this before on the show, but I think the most important thing to keep in mind is just the compressed nature of the modernization experience, how just in one working lifetime, you went, you know, in 1978, 1979 to today, it's like one person's lifetime. If you were a graduate from, you know, junior high and you started your first job in 79, at the dawn of reform and opening, the you know, per capita GDP was like less than $200, right? And today it's like 16.
And some people were living like just about medieval lives. Yeah, yeah. Cooking on fire.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Urban people in the hutongs in Beijing cooking on actual open fires.
That's right.
Going to a latrine, like non-flush, no plumbing. Yeah.
So romantic, right?
So romantic. I think there's the other thing is the economic dislocation that went with that modernization and industrialization, where when we were first in China, people just assumed we were really rich because we were from foreign countries. And, you know, and in fact, we, in terms of disposable income, we generally were quite rich. And now, like, all our Chinese friends have Lamborghinis. You know, there's the story you tell about in your last years in Beijing in that apartment building, and you're the guy on the electric moped.
Right.
And everybody else has a Lamborghini or a Ferrari.
Yeah, I was a freaking director at Baidu. I was pulling down, you know, good money even.
Yeah.
But everyone was it was insane. Actually, that came from, so Evan Osnos did that, remember that This American Life episode with you and me in it, right?
Right.
So the bumper they used, they didn't end up putting it in the show, but the one that they put on like the previous week's show was him and me walking around in the garage and me kind of like pointing to the different vehicles.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember listening to that. Right, yeah. This is a Lamborghini. This is a Maserati. Yeah.
Right. And then saying, here's my vehicle. You know, it's a little electric bicycle.
Right. I know. So, I mean, there's that, right? There's the incredibly. I think when we say, like, you know, how do you understand Chinese people? I mean, we are talking about China now. We're not talking about the eternal Chinese person that goes
just
back 5,000 years or something.
So let me just finish out that thought really quickly. But I think those are basically three things that you should know that come out of that observation about that, you know, compressed experience of modernization. One is that they're going to have a different relationship with technology, right? They have basically never known a time where, you know, improvements in their technological lives and improvements in their, you know, their other lives, in their health, in their education, in their housing, in their income generally, haven't improved in lockstep, right? So they don't have this the same kind of fear of technology that seems to be so pervasive now in the West. And the second is that, you know, I mean, this is something that Barry Naughton said a long time ago, but I think it's absolutely true. They're going to have a little bit of faith, a little more faith in the ability of their leadership to steer them through really kind of difficult, you know, and very, very rapid change. And the third thing I think is pretty, this is my, I use the Tom Hanks movie Big to illustrate this. You know, in that movie, a young 11-year-old, you know, actor who's playing the same guy as Tom Hanks later on, he makes a wish at this, you know, fortune-telling machine at a Midway carnival to grow up. You know, I wish I were big. And the next morning he wakes up and he's like Tom Hanks, you know, it was like in his 30s then. That's China, right? It has the outward appearance of an adult. You know, you got the gleaming forest skyscrapers and the amazing, you know, tech industry and the amazing high-speed rails. But the software hasn't changed that much. It just doesn't update as quickly. And so in this one lifetime, so that explains the thin-skinned nature, why they still have such a chip on their shoulder about so many things, why it still, you know, hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. It's why, you know,
Messi didn't play in Hong Kong, and now Hu Xijin is having a fit. Yeah.
Exactly. It's this readiness to feel offense. And I think that
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So,
now, here's the interesting thing, because I think, you know, we are going through, the next decade is going to be different. And, you know, there's an economic slowdown, and no matter what happens, it's not we're not, I mean, I don't think anybody serious thinks we're going to suddenly go back to the go-go years with, you know, 8% growth or whatever. So everybody's going to have to get used to much slower growth, slower technological progress, slower material progress. I mean, when you go from a latrine toilet to like a, you know, apartment that looks like a five-star hotel room.
Where do you go from there?
How do you make it feel better tomorrow, you know? So I think the next few years...
You played it with gold.
You played it with gold, that's right.
Hey, so what about some of the ideas that you find to be especially pernicious, but, you know, commonplace among people who actually do work on contemporary China? Well, are there some things that are, you know, common, kind of everyone seems to believe this, but not me?
I don't know. I don't think there's any one thing in particular I can say. I think I would just say that there's a tendency which I have to guard against in myself to settle into certain views about China. And once you're in, you know, a certain camp, to not be willing to get out of that camp. And I think it goes both ways. You get you know, get extremely defensive about how wonderful the Communist Party is, and you get people who can't hear the word China without saying, you know, terrible things about it. I think that's the most dangerous trap. And it's, you know, different people are guilty of it. Some people all of the time, some people just some of the time. I think all of us probably can be a little bit guilty of it if you engage with
none
China.
None of us, none of the time.
It's an incredibly frustrating place to engage with, you know, no matter what your views are. So, I think that's the thing.
I can readily confess to feeling this instinct to be defensive, right? I mean,
I mean, I think that's fairly obvious if you know your work, right? And as it's probably equally obvious that my first instinct is to be critical.
But I can fight it down. You can fight it down. I mean, it's possible to do. It's just we have to be conscientious about it.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't want to fight it down, right? Because sometimes that's the right instinct. So, I mean, that's the tough thing, I think. You've got to, you can't just relax and, if you want to be honest, you can't just relax and settle into a way of thinking about China.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, obviously because of my own ethnic roots, because of, you know, my own socialization, and, you know, because I'm married into a Chinese family, because, you know, I it's like, that's my mother you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I get it. I mean, in some ways, me too, right?
You lived there for so long. Yeah, you did. You were like 23 to 43 or something like that, is that?
Yeah, roughly.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, 23 to 43. Yeah, gosh.
I remember thinking that because I once came up with a little song to the Ballad of Davy Crockett, and to introduce you on the and I had to think 20 years in China from the age of 23 and known to his friends.
Now he moved to the green estate in the land of Tennessee.
Yeah, I'm gonna miss, you know, if not having you on the show as much, so I can't come up with those stupid intros.
I mean, every week would be a bit much, so it's probably better this way.
I could do it.
I can make
you
the right choice. Yeah, no, I know you're good.
American politics hands.
So let me turn the tables on you, because you've mostly been questioning me. You must get asked a lot by younger people who have studied Chinese, who are interested in China, lived there for a little bit, who are interested in pursuing a career that relates to China in some way. Do you have any stock advice that you give?
Well, I mean, I have a stock a thing that I tell them, which is like, don't look at me. I lucked into freaking everything. I never like deliberately set out to. I got phenomenally lucky. So I'm the worst person to look to as sort of a model for, you know, how to plan career success when it comes to China. Now, but I don't think I can offer much advice except kind of the cognitive advice. I mean, you know, the old things that we always say, like, you have to be able to keep two ideas in your head that are totally contradictory at the same time, and they can both be true. And I can rattle off a bunch of things, you know, that I know both to be true. Like, one, you know, these are things that kind of roll off my tongue now with real ease. I know, for example, with absolute confidence that Chinese are more freighted and burdened by their history. You know, they suffer from such inertia because of that great burden of history than anyone else in the world. And also, Chinese are the people who are like most capable of instantaneous self-reinvention in the whole world. I mean, those things are both true to me, and they're completely opposite, right? So, yeah. I mean, it's the cognitive stuff like that. I mean, you know, I give them my, hey, you got to be really, really humble. You have to know what you don't know. You have to be totally aware of your epistemic limitations when it comes to China, because it's freaking opaque, right? There's just a lot of stuff you're never going to know. So don't believe those people who make these, you know, grand conclusions based on, you know, cherry-picked quotes from some Xi Jinping speech. You know, and because somebody can do the exact same to prove the exact opposite point. I tell them, you know, the important thing is country feel. I mean, just you just have to have this sort of intuition. And the only way to acquire that is by prolonged exposure. And of course, the really tragic thing is that nobody, I mean, you know, there's single digit hundreds of people now studying in China. And, you know, there were 100,000 of them when we were there, right?
Yeah, it's a very different environment you know, lots of different reasons. I mean, my advice is much more practical. I just say to people, you know, you probably won't be able to make much money out of it, so you better make sure that you're interested and engage with it, because it's not like a career choice to do China stuff, really. It's a choice of interest. And, you know, in many cases like ours, you have to kind of make up a career if you want to, you know, do it.
We're both doing that again. Yeah, speaking of which, what career are you going to make up now?
Well, you know, I need to have a bit of a break from regular publishing. I mean, having basically been doing it since 1997, I need a break from the, like, weekly or daily media production life. So I'm working as an editorial fellow for Chinafile. So I'm doing editing work. And I'm doing a bit of other writing and fiddling about and just trying to decide what I want to do when I grow up, really, and spending a lot of time with my children.
Oh, that's good.
Because they're still at an age where they actually like me. So they say. I mean, I need to just think a bit, I think.
Yeah. I understand you've been fishing and depleting the fish stocks in your little pond.
Well, I actually I restocked it before the winter with catfish, so hopefully that's
Nianyu.
And they're good. It's different. We had this fish in South Africa called barbel, which is a kind of catfish, but they weren't very good. But these Southern American catfish are very good to eat.
Oh yeah. You know, catfish is really great in shuijuyu. So you get So nice. I can recommend you a really good shuijuyu kind of like prep mix. Is just absolutely delicious, yeah.
Oh, good. Baijia. My son is starting to like spicy food, so we can good.
Hey, you know, we were just talking about like our generation back then. What was special to you, do you think, about our generation of China analysts? You know, people who are now in their, I guess, 40s, 50s, maybe even early 60s, right, who went to China, let's say, in their 20s or 30s, and back, you know, in the 80s, in the 90s, maybe even, you know, anything pre-Olympic, really. I feel like there's a different flavor to them than the people who went after. What do you think are the common experiences that molded us and gave us our approach, and insofar as there is one, that shared kind of particular character?
Well, I think one thing is that before 2008, I mean, maybe it was already changing, you know, post-WTO, but before 2008, let's say, China wasn't a glamorous place to go, really.
Not at all.
Certainly in the 90s and early 2000s, the average American or South African or Brit thought you were a complete oddball if you chose to go to China. You know, it was a hardship posting for multinational companies. So people who went at that time, it attracted us, and it wasn't people who went to Thailand and, you know, chilled out on the beach, because China was never like that. I mean, even if you were in Hainan Island, it wasn't like that. So you had to be driven by something aside from the search for an easy life or, you know, prestige. You were driven by some other weird thing. So, I mean, there were a lot of, you know, oddballs and eccentric people and characters and people who may not particularly eccentric, but certainly were driven by something a little unusual. I think that's one factor. I think the other thing that sort of started in the 80s in a very small way and then really gathered speed in like the 90s and early 2000s was Brendan O'Kane, who's a scholar of Chinese literature and translator and old friend of ours. he used to have this thing. What did he call it? Feral sinologists.
Feral sinologists.
Feral sinologists, right? And right. I guess the idea was that, whereas before the 90s, if you wanted to study China, you actually had to get a really formal job, or you had to go through some very limited channels, you know, studying at a university. Whereas from the 90s, you could just go to China and get a job teaching English and teach yourself Chinese in a dormitory and like just kind of live in China and study China in the field, right?
Yeah, you are the archetypal feral sinologist.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't study Chinese at university because there wasn't any Chinese classes in South Africa when I was at university.
Right.
And then I lived in a workers' dormitory and learned Chinese from migrant workers. So, you know, that was a rather different experience than was available really much before then, because, you know, you couldn't, I mean, from, you know, I mean, Jeremy Barme, my friend, was in the Cultural Revolution, the later years of, you know, in the 70s at university in China, and they weren't allowed to associate with Chinese students too much. And that lasted really until the early 1990s. You know, the universities were segregated. Whereas if you got a job and lived in a workers' dormitory, there was no segregation. You could actually learn more language than was available to university students. So it was, you know, I mean, a lot of people learned a lot of good stuff at university too. I'm not deriding it in any way, but there was a lot of ways to learn about China that suddenly opened up to us.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I would have said. I mean, that's what it is that we had the ability to go to China and just actually sort of live there and absorb it and get that country feel that I keep talking about. I don't know what else to call it. I'm sure there's a good German word for it. It always is. It's just a kind of set of intuitions and I mean, part of it obviously is linguistic facility and all that stuff. But anyway, yeah, man.
I think it's also just getting into problems, like, you know, when you're on tour with Tang Dynasty or like me, you know, doing media startups, and you have like problems in society, and you have to solve them in some way. And then you start to see patterns that you can also see in sometimes the way the government behaves. And
oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I had that. That was. You know, I keep thinking about how many times, you know, we ran into the same sorts of problems and the very creative solutions that we came up with. Like, you know, that venue operator who just decided to escape through the bathroom window rather than actually paying the band.
Right. Yeah. We saw that happen in other circumstances, right? Right.
Or having. You know, the hotel won't let you leave because your bill's not paid. So, you know, you learn how to tie sheets together with knots good enough to lower, you know, Marshall stack heads out the window. And, you know, how many symbols you could put into a single bed sheet. And, yeah, man. Yeah. What a blast it's been talking to you about this stuff. I mean, that little stroll down memory lane, but I think there's you know, useful and maybe even wise pearls that you've helped dispense here. That
I hope it's not too much of a wank.
You know, I look forward to getting you back on and chatting some more about this stuff, because we have not even come close to exhausting what we could talk about.
Yeah, it's been fun.
So Jeremy, one more time. Yeah. Before we go to recommendations and all that stuff, tell me. I hear you might be working on a book. Is that possible?
Oh yeah, I'm scribbling some things down. So yeah, I'm trying to, you know, figure out.
Okay.
How to make a book?
I'm trying to imagine what it would be like for somebody who can't touch type to actually write a book. I mean, you learn Chinese by yourself in a dorm. I mean, maybe you could learn to touch type and it would save you a lot.
I type at the right speed for thinking.
I see. Okay. Yeah, you could do the same on it, like on a phone, right? With your thumbs. All right, man. Hey, listen, I want to make a quick appeal for you listeners for help. When I learned about the impending demise of the China Project, I really resolved that I was going to keep Seneca going in some way. I had to wait a little bit for the dust to settle, but, you know, I've known all along that I wanted to continue producing what I believe are really high-quality conversations that explore what is behind the news. I'm still driven primarily by that mission, but I also have a family to feed. And as of this fall, I'm going to have two kids in college, most likely two kids out of state for college. So I need your help. So consider supporting my work in one of three ways. You can sign up for Patreon, where I'm asking for just $10 a month, or subscribe to the new Seneca Substack, which I will be launching in time for the release of this program. Either way, you will get the transcript to the show. You'll get a weekly essay by me or some other on you know, a China-related subject, something near and dear to my heart. I'm talking to some of your favorite contributors from the China Project about maybe including some of their writing as part of that offering. You will also get bonus podcast episodes, recordings of things like, you know, talks that I'm giving, public talks, audio versions of essays, much more than that. I'm working on some really cool translation projects that I'll hopefully be keeping you abreast of. I also plan to take the show on the road, so subscribers are going to have big discounts on admission price for live Seneca shows and the mini conferences that I'm hoping to put on. And so if you run a company or a center, if you work at a law firm or run a law firm or a think tank or something, please consider sponsoring Seneca. Every bit makes a difference. So shoot me an email at senecapod@gmail.com and let's talk about what we might do together. Or if you're interested in having Seneca come to your town for a live event, let's talk about how we can make that happen. All right. All right, Jeremy, you ready to go on to recommendations?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, you're up first, as is our habit.
So first thing, obviously, I'm just going to plug what I'm doing now, China File.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. Susie Jakes, yeah.
Yeah, Susie Jakes is amazing.
She really is.
So that's just ChinaFile.com. And then my book recommendation is a book called The Ghosts of Evolution by Connie Barlow. And this is something I discovered because a couple of years ago in the fall, I was walking through the woods near my home in the holler west of Nashville.
Storied gold corn holler.
That's right. And I came across this large, like, fruit thing that was shiny and then a pattern sort of like a walnut, looked like a brain almost, a bright green, like lime, bright lime green. And I looked it up, and it's something called an Osage orange is one of its names, and it's got a bunch of other names. And it's this enormous fruit that is inedible. So, in other words, there's no reason for it to be a fruit. Nobody eats it. No animals eat it. And I discovered that it's what they call an evolutionary anachronism. So there used to be megafauna, like mammoths and giant sloths, used to eat this fruit. That's why the fruit evolved, and poop it out and then distribute the seeds. And then those megafauna died off, but the fruit is still around. And it was used for a short time by the tree. The Osage Native Americans used to make bows out of it because it's...
Yeah, it's great wood for bows.
It's the best in the world. Very high work to tension, or I don't know what the right word is.
Yeah.
And then the settlers, European settlers who, you know, made farms in the U.S. used it to fence off like cattle fields. But then barbed wire was invented, so they stopped doing that. And, you know, nobody was hunting with bows in large numbers. So nobody was using the tree anymore, and it's still around. Anyway, this extraordinary bright green fruit, monkey brain is the other name for the fruit, which is quite evocative. And so I wanted to learn about this, and there's this book called The Ghosts of Evolution by Connie Barlow, and it's all about these kind of evolutionary anachronisms, things that evolved for a certain reason, and that reason no longer exists. And among them is the ginkgo tree, which is probably familiar to all of us.
Yeah, I actually take ginkgo, an extract of ginkgo leaves, supposedly good for my neurological condition.
The supplement business is the biggest business.
Yeah, especially if you're Chinese.
It's a big business.
I mean, it's always like all the Chinese people in that supplements aisle at Costco.
Well, I think Americans actually have that in common with Chinese people. Have you looked at the supplement section of your local supermarket?
I have. It's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, I take so... All right. Great recommendation, Jeremy. That's really, really cool. So Connie is like C-O-N-N-I-E, or is it?
That's right. And okay. Barlow, B-A-R-L-O-W.
Oh, cool. Excellent. I'm going to get that. Yeah. All right. So one thing that I can say for having taken all this time off is that I have accumulated a good long list of recommendations. So I'm going to do one that's very self-serving and then one that's just plain fun. So the self-serving one is my brother, Jay, who is a Broadway writer and producer and a lawyer, actually, by training. He puts out this Substack called The Status Quo, K-U-O. Check that out. But he wrote a book called Ma in all caps, which is sort of a family memoir. He calls it a memoir, focused on my mom and on the distaff side of our family. And it stretches back over a whole century. It's got, you know, quite a bit of history in it. He describes it as Amy Tan meets David Sedaris, because, yeah, it is very, it's funny. It focuses on sort of humorous things that have happened. And, you know, it's about as accurate a description as I could come up with. Amy Tan meets David Sedaris. Around Thanksgiving, I started doing the audiobook recording of that book, and it is now out on audible.com. I have to say it was very challenging to do all the accents. I had to do like this German missionary and Italians and then, of course, you know, lots of different Chinese accents rendered into what he believed were kind of the English-speaking world's equivalent. So I have kind of like this 1920s mid-Atlantic that I'd use for my maternal grandmother. Anyway, check it out. The audiobook is a lot of fun. I think you'll actually enjoy it and learn something about the crazy family that I come from. The other recommendation I have is for the novels of a Spanish writer named Arturo Perez Reverte. They're called the Alatriste novels, about Captain Alatriste. There are 7 of them available in English so far. I have devoured them all during this hiatus. They are set in Spain's Golden Age during, you know, the earlier part of the 30 Years' War, up to like the 1630s. And they're told in first person from the perspective of this young Basque soldier whose father is killed fighting in Flanders, and the dead father asks his best friend, the Captain Alatriste of the title, to raise his son. So it's, you know, Alatriste is the central character, and it's written by his, you know, his young ward. Alatriste is like this mercenary, he's like this deadly swordsman, but with like this poet's soul. You know, he's just the coolest cat. Actually, in the movie version of this, he's played by Viggo Mortensen, if you can get an idea of how cool he is. Viggo Mortensen, by the way, who grew up in Latin America, speaks fluent Castilian Spanish, and it's really, really cool to watch him. But Alatriste is, this whole book series, like any good historical fiction, it's a vehicle for learning about that time period. So this is, you know, Spain at the height of its decadence, but also, you know, where the culture is at its full flower. You know, Cervantes, the playwright, Lope de Vega, are characters in it, or Cervantes is in there a lot, but the poet, actually, Francisco de Quevedo, is a major character in the book, and it is shot through with all sorts of really great humor. They're just a blast. The English translations are by this woman named Margaret Sayers Peden, and they are extraordinarily skillful because of the way she presents the many, many poems in the book, tons of poems. And they're rendered in the original rhyme and meter. They're all preserved really well, so it's quite a skill. Yeah, so Arturo Perez Reverte, the Alatriste novels. That's my recommendation. Jeremy, man, what a blast.
Yeah, what a blast for us. I hope the listeners don't think it's too much of a wank, but I had fun.
Okay. All right, off I go then.
That was fun, Kaiser. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Seneca Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me, Kaiser Guo. Support the show at patreon.com/Seneca or at seneca.substack.com, or email me at senecapod@gmail.com if you have ideas on how you can help out. Thanks to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.